Support for this public radio podcast comes from Thrivent Financial, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. ThriveInFinancial.com/retirement.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. When it comes to investing, it helps to have a little bit of early warning.
The indicator has flashed 10 buy signals between the late 1940s and the late 1970s.
That's Norman Fosbach with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. What kind of indicator is he talking about? Is it A, the airline merge indicator? With high fuel costs, it may be easier to finalize a deal between Air France and Alitalia Airlines. Or is it B, the recession buy indicator? Can it be it shows there may be an end to the sour economy? Or maybe it's C, the gas is how high indicator? In 1947, the economy went crazy after gas hit 25 cents a gallon. Now it's more than $4 in some places. Only one answer is correct. Find out which one on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. How do you know when the economy's hit bottom? It's a popular question these days. I thought maybe the season finale of Gossip Girl would reveal the answer. It didn't. XOXO. But turns out there's something else that might. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
'Twas not a pretty week, was it? Oil prices apparently no ceiling. The Fed released minutes of its last meeting, and all signs point to the end of interest rate cuts. And the Oracle of Omaha himself, Warren Buffett, predicted this week that the current financial crisis will be longer and deeper than many economists think. Great. Well, here's a possible bright spot. Something called the recession buy indicator is indicating that it's time to buy into the market. We've invited the indicator's inventor to join us. Norman Fosbach puts out a newsletter called Fosbach's Fund Forecaster. And please tell us, what is the recession buy indicator?
The recession buy indicator is premised on the concept that when it comes to the stock market and the economy, it's darkest before the dawn. The government keeps many indicators of the state of the economy. Four of them comprise what is called the Index of Coincident Indicators: industrial production, manufacturing and trade sales, non-agricultural employment, and personal income. When all four of these indicators are down from their levels of 6 months ago, more than likely the stock market will soon turn to the upside, anticipating the future, the next economic expansion.
And have we hit that point?
We just hit it 2 weeks ago.
What's your batting average?
So far, it's 100%.
Ah.
The indicator has flashed 10 buy signals prior to this point. About half of those were between the late 1940s and the late 1970s when I developed this indicator.
A lot of people are saying that this current recession, assuming that we're in one, of course, it has not been declared officially yet, that it's different from the ones that we've seen in the past because of the credit crunch and the mortgage crisis. Do you think that our current situation could prove the exception to your rule?
No. It always seems different this time. Whenever you're living a business slowdown, it seems worse than simply reading about all the previous ones historically. Now, from the consumer standpoint, it's been very visible, and this one has, while being different in that respect, has been relatively mild. It doesn't show any particular signs of becoming worse. Indeed, the Federal Reserve has been very aggressive in its efforts to stimulate the economy, and there's every indication that it's succeeding in that regard.
So would this indicator then give lie to some of the economic pundits out there who have said that we are nowhere near the bottom and that things are going to get much, much worse before they get better?
I think so. You know, what happened today when it comes to the stock market is history. What happened yesterday is ancient history. What counts is the future. And the stock market typically looks out about 6 to 12 months. It doesn't really focus on the fact that we happen to be in a recession today.
So our general advice to the average investor is always don't try to time the market. What would your advice be?
Well, obviously, many investors should not time the market. What investors should understand from this particular indicator is that you should not be panicked by the current headlines. You should follow the dictum, this too shall pass, that there will be better days ahead, and that the time to start buying or the time to use money to buy and the time not to panic into selling is simply when the headlines appear to be the bleakest. That's the very time that the smart money on Wall Street starts to buy and has finished their selling.
So as the designer of the recession buy indicator, the founder, what have you, are you buying in now?
Yes. In my investment newsletters, I'm advising our readers to add to their positions of mutual funds and stocks at this point.
Well, Norman Fosbach, thanks so much for your time.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Norman Fosbach is the editor of Fosbach's Fund Forecaster.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
If you invest in muni bonds, you know that in most of the country, the profit you make on them isn't taxed as long as the bonds are for a project in your state. If they're in another state, you do pay taxes. Well, this week, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld that rule in the 42 states that exempt their own bonds from taxation. We decided to take this opportunity to talk about the current climate for investing in munis. David Weiss of Standard & Poor's joins us. Hi, David.
Hello.
So typically, muni bond investors are in the high tax bracket. Why should people in lower tax brackets care about this recent Supreme Court ruling?
Well, first of all, if you're in a low tax bracket, you're probably not interested in buying muni bonds because the main advantage they have is their tax exemption. Not paying much tax, you don't want to pay much for that. But on the other hand, you're a taxpayer too, and you pay taxes to your local government. The ability to sell low interest rate bonds is helped by the tax exempt status. Therefore, your taxes are going to be lower. The cost of borrowing for your school district and town is going to be lower under the current law, most likely, than if the Supreme Court had ruled in the other direction.
What kind of effect has the credit crunch had on muni bonds and investors' ability to get into them and get a good return?
It's affected in two ways. One is that people are increasingly worried about some of the bond insurers. They have insured these bonds. They effectively provided liquidity for the marketplace. That's important mainly for smaller issuers, or especially for the smaller issuers, the smaller towns, the special districts. Mm-hmm. The other difference, we have had a problem with some of these short-term auction rate notes, which has been well publicized. Some of that was getting a little carried away with using them. Some of it was people are suddenly upset by the fact that these are based on short-term interest rates, and short-term interest rates fluctuate.
If there is this problem with bond insurers, then should investors be worried that the bonds that they're in could get in trouble?
I don't think you should be worried because, number one, if you're in have a reasonably highly rated bond, you still have the full faith and credit of the government behind it. It probably makes more difference if you bought bonds from a less trustworthy source, shall we say, somebody who's more likely to default, or especially in some of the smaller special use districts.
Is now a good time to invest in muni bonds?
I think it's a great time to invest because the yields are high. We've never seen yields this high relative to the yields on treasuries. And if you're in a high tax bracket, my personal feeling is tax rates are much more likely to go up after the election than down. So the tax exemption is going to be worth more.
So is that something where the average investor, say in a 401k or some other general plan, could get into muni bonds through an index fund?
Never put muni bonds into a 401k.
Ah.
Because you're wasting the tax advantage. The whole advantage of a 401k is that you have tax-deferred income. So you do not want to put any tax-exempt security into a 401k plan or an IRA.
Okay.
These should be held in taxable accounts. And they're generally only for people in relatively high tax brackets. You really have to look at the after-tax return and figure it out for yourself. But if you're in a high tax bracket, these are winning bets. If you're in a low tax bracket, buy something else.
David Weiss is the chief economist for Standard & Poor's. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, are we ever going to see oil prices go down ever again in our lifetimes?
Oh, yes. Oil prices will go down
okay.
a little bit.
How about wheat and corn and rice? You know, I have to say, if you ask me, it looks like this commodity market is something approaching another bubble.
You're probably right.
You know, I think the folks who are getting most of the blame here are the speculators who are getting into these markets as they're climbing and climbing and climbing, and they're pushing prices up. This sounds to me a whole lot like the dot-com boom and the housing boom, where speculators get us all into trouble.
You know, I love speculators.
Excuse me?
I do. I may be one of the few people that love speculators. But Tess, you know what? Commodities, maybe you're right, it's a bubble. Maybe it isn't. If I were to boil down my position, I think that booms and busts, they're basically a good thing.
How can busts be a good thing, my friend? Explain, please.
Okay. Take commodities right now.
Mm-hmm.
What does this reflect? It reflects one of the most hopeful signs of the past half century, the emergence of China and India. And while those higher commodity prices are encouraging, on the one hand, investment in alternative energy, some of it's a dead end. On the other hand, what the high price of agriculture is telling us is we need to be investing more in research and development. So, you know, I think a lot of good comes out of bubbles as long as we can limit the damage of the bust.
So you're saying that long-term gain is worth short-term pain for a lot of people?
Yes. Now, come back to me and say, look, you know, this is all very fine for an industrialized nation and a wealthy nation like the U.S. and Europe and Japan.
Although it's not very fine because you have people who can't pay their gas bills and they can't pay their food bills.
Very few. Most people can. They're just having to tighten up their budget.
Okay.
Now, if you go to Bangladesh or some of the developing nations where 98% of a household's budget is going to food, there's a different situation. So I don't want to minimize that. And I don't want to minimize among the poor in the U.S. or the poor in Europe or Japan. But by and large, what the increase in commodities reflects are these fundamental developments. And without speculators, you don't get this kind of action. And I would include our domestic real estate boom and bust here in that category.
Okay, well, tell me what the upside was in that. I mean, look at all the people being thrown out of their houses. The economy is in recession in large part because of the speculation during the housing boom.
First of all, you know what? The U.S. housing stock has had a tremendous improvement overall. By and large, it was good for the country. It went a little bit crazy. If you are in a poor neighborhood where there was a lot of subprime abuses going on, that was really bad. But overall, I think that there were some positive things that came out of the boom. And the big question is, can the Federal Reserve limit the bust?
All right. I'm not sure you've convinced me yet, but I suppose you're a little kind of on your way.
Well, it's a good discussion. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, who from now on I'm going to call Bubble Bob. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
Believe it or not, some people live without any debt, but that means they probably don't have a credit score. What if they could prove their financial worthiness another way?
There's nothing non-traditional about it. It shouldn't stigmatize anybody by showing they pay their bills on time.
We'll take a look at alternative credit scores. Stay with us for more Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. There are a few basic personal finance concepts we try to hammer into your skulls pretty much every week. Save money for retirement, get rid of debt, pay attention to your credit score. But what if you're so good about not accumulating debt that you don't even have a credit score? Some 50 million people in the U.S. don't, and that can make it tough to navigate this modern financial world. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports on efforts to establish alternative credit scores.
This is the car Sherry Smalley was beginning to think she'd never own.
And it's a nice little car.
Smalley is a young 51 years old with tattoos on both arms and a two-tone hairdo. She runs a golf course restaurant in Phoenix. After a recent car accident, she decided to trade in her 86 Camaro for something a little safer. But her bank turned her down for an auto loan.
The reason they gave me was that I didn't have any credit score at all. Not bad credit, just no credit. So they wouldn't give me a car loan.
Smalley tried several dealers. Just one would give her a loan with a 25% interest rate. She passed. An estimated 50 million people in this country are in the same boat. They have what's called a thin credit file, or no file at all. Many are young people and new immigrants who just haven't had the chance to establish credit. Smalley just never thought debt was a good idea until she needed it.
I had always thought that if you worked hard and saved money and bought the things you wanted, you were doing good in life. But come to find out at 51 years of age that because I had never established any credit by buying on credit, that I couldn't get credit. So I was pretty much not going to be able to have a car at all.
Then Smalley found out about a program at a local credit union. Traditional credit scores rely on a credit history. But by proving that she'd paid her basic bills on time, rent, life insurance, cell phone, Smalley was able to get an alternative credit score, a respectable 653.
And I was able to go out and buy absolutely the car of my dreams. It's a little 01 PT Cruiser that is just gorgeous and it fits me just perfect.
Smalley's credit score came from a company called Pay Rent Build Credit, or PRBC. Founder Michael Nathans thought it was unfair that mortgage payments were reported to the major credit bureaus, but rent didn't count. Now customers can report all kinds of bill payments. PRBC verifies them and provides the data to lenders. The company is known as an alternative credit bureau, but Nathans bristles at the term.
Rental, cable, electric, phone, all these payments have for so many years been called non-traditional or alternative type data, when in fact, there's nothing non-traditional about it. It shouldn't stigmatize anybody. No one should feel they're in any kind of ghetto by showing they pay their bills on time.
The mainstream credit industry is catching on. Fair Isaac is now using PRBC's data for its FICO expansion score. A few months ago, Experian launched what it calls an emerging score. It's based in part on payments to book and CD of the month clubs. Zaydoun Munir is head of marketing and product development at Experian. He says the new score is helping lenders reach what the industry calls the underserved.
In looking at the risk policies of our clients, 20 to 25% of those consumers who otherwise would have not been served by these mainstream lenders would have qualified.
Munir won't say who those lenders are, but big names like Citigroup and Citizens Home Loan are starting to use alternative data to make loans. Jennifer Tesher directs the nonprofit Center for Financial Services Innovation. The group funds credit bureaus like PRBC. Tesher says lenders have estimated that reaching out to underserved consumers could generate anywhere from $6 billion to $45 billion in loans per year. The subprime mortgage collapse may have set the effort back. Lenders are naturally more cautious these days, but Tesher says they're also open to finding better tools to measure credit risk. And she says it's a mistake to assume that people with thin or no credit files are subprime borrowers.
In fact, it appears that a majority of them are not subprime. And it's also important to remember that not all subprime borrowers are bad. What we saw in the mortgage markets was incredibly shoddy lending practices. It wasn't we had bad data. It was we chose not to ask questions.
Some are asking questions about how good these alternative credit scores really are for consumers. Privacy advocates worry more data is being collected that could fall into the wrong hands. Then there's the added temptation for even more consumers to get overextended. In Phoenix, Sherry Smalley is grappling with the fact that for the first time in her life, she's in debt. Since the car loan came through a few months ago, she's applied for a few credit cards. She's thinking about buying a condo now that she qualifies for a mortgage. But she says she's sticking with the car payment for now.
It's almost scary, but it's a fantastic feeling paying that bill every month. It just is so wonderful to know that someone trusted me that much that they gave me this car knowing that I would pay for it every month.
And so far, she has. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace Money.
Several of you have written to us recently about debt collection. You've gotten notices in the mail that you owe money on, say, a phone bill from 20 years ago. Well, you've joined a growing chorus of complaints about debt collectors. The Better Business Bureau says complaints jumped 26% last year. Ashley Millen-Tite reports on what you can do if you're feeling hounded by a collection agency.
Michael McAuliffe hears from consumers in trouble every day. He's run Family Credit Management, a nonprofit credit counseling service, for almost 10 years. But he's increasingly concerned by what clients are saying about their calls from debt collectors.
We're hearing more and more people saying, they told me they're going to send the sheriff to my house, I'm going to go to jail. And that scares people because when you're calling as a collector, they think that you must know what you're talking about.
He says plenty of collectors don't. Or they break the law by lying to consumers about what can happen if they don't pay up. The Fair Debt Collections Act says collectors can't threaten debtors. It bans calls before 8 a.m. and after 9 p.m. And it prevents collectors from discussing the debt with anyone but the debtor. Ira Reingold is executive director of the National Association of Consumer Advocates. He says some collectors ignore the rules because there's a lot of money at stake.
Debt collection is a gigantic business. And as amazing as it sounds, there are industries dedicated to buying debt that are years old.
Most lenders, like banks, will try to collect a debt for several months. Once they decide it's more trouble than it's worth, they often sell that debt for pennies on the dollar to a debt collection company. That company then goes after the debt, aiming to recoup the full amount. Their employees work on commission. So Reingold says they're highly motivated to call consumers and call and call, be it in person or via an automated service like this one.
This is an attempt to collect a debt, and any information obtained will be used for that purpose. Please contact us about an important business matter at 1-800.
More and more Americans are getting calls like this these days. Ira Reingold says it's partly because the country is wallowing in debt. And he says the third-party debt collection business has exploded over the last several years. Credit counselor Michael McAuliffe says if these collectors won't leave you alone and you owe the debt, you should face up to it.
Avoiding it's not going to be helpful. So they need to look at the problem head on, see can they make any payments or not.
But what if you're convinced the debt isn't yours? Allison Pressler is a spokesperson with the Better Business Bureau.
Tell the debt collector that you want proof of this debt, and if they can't produce it, then they should leave you alone. You can always file a complaint with the FTC. You can file a complaint with your Better Business Bureau.
But that may not be the end of the matter, says Ira Reingold. He says even if you ask the debt collector to prove the debt is yours and you never hear from them again,
it is likely that debt is going to be sold to somebody else who's going to come around further and try to collect your debt.
He advises hiring an attorney, like him, who represents consumers in these matters. He says people should check their credit reports regularly to ensure they're not lumbered with someone else's debt. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
It's time once again for Getting Personal, when we help solve your money problems. And with me once again is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello again, Chris.
Hello again, Tess.
Cindy is on the line from Boise, Idaho. Hi, Cindy.
Hello.
What's your question for Chris today?
Well, I have a two-part question.
Okay.
My husband, his father's company paid for him to take helicopter lessons.
Ooh, fun.
And he feels very obligated because we're not working for that company to pay him back the $30,000. We own a home in Boise, and we bought it at a higher interest rate, and we're thinking about refinancing. And we also own a home in Lewiston, Idaho, and we're thinking about selling or refinancing that house because it's on a 7-year adjusted rate mortgage.
Okay.
So we're trying to figure out what's best to lower our monthly payment here in Boise and pay back the $30,000.
So you would want to potentially sell the Lewiston home in order to help pay off the helicopter lessons?
Yes.
Okay.
Here's the big question. If we sell the Lewiston house, how do we avoid huge capital gains tax?
Ah.
Okay, so it's a rental property in Lewiston?
Yes, it is.
Okay. The answers to all your questions is the Lewiston home.
Okay.
Because that's your rental property, and if you sell it, you're right, you will pay capital gains, but you'll also have, I would assume, some profit left over, which then would improve your financial situation and would make refinancing probably even easier than it already is.
So what kind of capital gains would they be facing with a second home that is a rental property?
The capital gain, you know, that difference between the sales price after expenses and what you originally paid for it and cost of purchase. So that's your capital gain, 15%. Then have you been taking depreciation on the rental property?
I don't think so.
Okay. Go out and get an accountant and have him or her really run the numbers for you. Because if you haven't been taking depreciation, there's a form that you can file for recapturing depreciation. There's a different tax rate on that. So what you really want to find out is if we sell this home after capital gains, and if we have to do recapture depreciation or not, how much do we have left over? And then you can look at your other financial situations. So that's the first thing that I would do. And by the way, if you decide not to sell it, then you can talk to the accountant and say, well, should we be taking depreciation? And how do we go about doing that? And how will that affect our income situation going forward? That, to me, is my key piece of advice.
I didn't know about the depreciation. We own an airplane and we depreciate that every year, but I didn't know you could depreciate rental property. So that does help.
Chris, can you explain that? Does depreciation only apply to rental property?
Because it's a business. And so anyone who is renting a home, it's one of the things that they can do. It's one of the benefits that the government gives you in terms of making it a lower cost investment. However, there's also a form that when you go to sell it, there's a recapture of depreciation test,
mm-hmm.
and that's taxed at a maximum rate of 25%.
So you can get tax benefits for depreciation even if your home is increasing in value?
Sure. We're talking rental property.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yes, you can take depreciation.
Well, there you go, Cindy.
Thank you very much.
All right. Our website is marketplace.org, and you can click on the Getting Personal link there to send us your email questions, or you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. All right, Chris, let's reach into the email bag, and Carl writes in from Suttons Bay, Michigan, and his question is whether there is any advantage or disadvantage in buying individual AAA-rated municipal bonds rather than a tax-free bond fund. Now, we've already talked about muni bonds a little earlier in the show. What's your answer to this question here? He says his broker seems to favor tax-free bond fund over individual bonds. Would you agree?
As a general rule, probably. It's not bad advice. Here's the trade-off. The reason why the broker probably favors the bond fund is that it's very cheap. And it's easy to get into. And typically the rule of thumb has been you don't buy individual municipal bonds unless you have at least $50,000 to invest.
Okay.
So that number's come down a little bit because of some efficiencies in the market, but it's still not a bad idea to keep in mind. Now, it is also true, and unfortunately I know better about New York State and California, I'm not sure about Michigan, that a municipality or the state is issuing a lot of debt. They've worked with the brokerage community to make it easier for individuals to buy smaller chunks of a municipal bond. But if that's not the situation you're facing, don't buy individual unless you've got a big chunk of money to invest. So your broker's giving you advice that's saying, look, you're going to get a little bit of diversification and you're going to have a cheap fee or a cheaper fee. And so it's not bad advice at all.
Once again, if you'd like to send us your question, just click on the Getting Personal link on our website. It's marketplace.org, or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Here at Marketplace, we don't have a whole lot to worry about in terms of work hazards. We don't even cut tape with razor blades anymore. But on this week's A Day in the Work Life, we're visiting a much more dangerous industry where the expression, stay sharp, takes on a whole new meaning.
My name is Frank Bush, Jr. I'm 52 years old and I work at Warsh Lumber in Cohasset, New York. I've been working in the lumber business approximately all my life. Contrary to popular belief, my car is not made out of wood, but it has enough sawdust and stuff on to look like it. I have sawdust on everything I own. My wife does think I smell like wood when I come home. However, I tell her that I could be working at a sewer treatment plant. She doesn't think the wood's so bad then. I love my job. An oak log, 50 years old, 14 feet long, would probably weigh somewhere in the vicinity of 750 pounds. That log would be cut up in approximately 2 to 3 minutes. Fortunately, after working in this business my whole life, I do have all my fingers. We sharpen the saw twice a day, and we can saw between 1 and 200,000 feet, depending on if you hit anything in the logs. If we suspect there's anything in a tree, we'll metal detect it. We have found barbed wire fence, horseshoes, bullets. Even now and again, we'll find concrete in a tree. Most of the lumber at the facility I work at is sawed into what we call sewer plank, which is sent to New York City to do construction work in the ditches and any other underground work that they would do, pipes, sewer pipes, electrical, and so forth. We do some retail work. We've had one guy that even thought he could carve a bathtub out of a big tree. To my knowledge, this bathtub is not completed yet. Right now in this country, our lumber business is in not very good shape. We are the last mill that runs full-time in Ulster County, which is the county we live in. And at one time, there was probably 50 or 60 mills in this area. A lot of the trees from the area where we're from in the Northeast get shipped into Canada, where it's turned into lumber and shipped back here for less than we can do it in our own country because they have government subsidies. And a lot of our high-quality lumber is put into containers and shipped to China. It costs more to ship them down to New York City on a truck than it does after they get to the boat to be shipped all the way to China. My salary is approximately $35,000 a year. When my wife and I go on vacation, we like to go out west, mainly to the mountains and mountain scenery with the trees and everything else. We like trees. We've been out west and seen the giant sequoias. I stood next to a tree that was 21 feet in diameter. I definitely did not want to cut that down.
You can learn more about Frank Bush Jr. at marketplace.org. A Day in the Work Life was produced by Wally Nichols. So what if your day in the work life became a day without a work life?
I was laid off, or I was working for a newspaper that folded, and I remember that unbelievable shock that it's coming to an end.
We'll have some first steps to take if you're downsized, and a smart way to check out those new smartphones for the crackberry in you. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. This weekend marks the official start of the summer travel season. You'd better be ready to travel light. This week, American Airlines announced it's going to charge $15 to check a bag. And that's just for the first one. But lost in the uproar over the new fee was another announcement from American. It's laying off thousands of workers. A familiar scene these days. So we wanted to get some tips for what to do if it happens to you. And here to help us is our old friend, MSN Money's Liz Pulliam-Weston. Good to see you again, Liz.
Thank you, Tess.
This is obviously a tough time for a lot of folks who are losing their jobs because of the economy. What is the very first thing that you should do if you find out that you're about to get pink-slipped?
Well, take a deep breath. It's going to be a huge shock. I was laid off, or I was working for a newspaper that folded, and I remember that unbelievable shock that it's coming to an end. The first thing you need to think about is unemployment benefits. A lot of people put it off, and that's silly because you have some waiting period, usually 2 weeks. You need that money. Sign up for it. You earned it. You've been paying for it. Your employer's been paying for it.
Why do people hold off?
I've had comments like, I'm worried it will hurt my credit scores.
Does it?
No, it doesn't affect your credit at all. I'm worried it will reflect badly on me somehow. People equate it to welfare, which it is so not. You know, this is a benefit that you and your employer have paid for going along. This is when you want to get it, when you need it. The next thing you want to do is find out what you're entitled to. Find out if you're going to get a severance package. It doesn't always come. Find out if you're going to get a lump sum for your unused vacation days if you have them. Find out if you can use those vacation days to stay on the payroll a little longer. That's actually the preferable option because that keeps you covered under your insurance and other benefits if you have them.
You mentioned that you were surprised when this happened to you. I think for some people, they make kind of sense that something's out there, something might be coming. What are some ways to tell if your employer is looking to, as they would say it, trim the fat?
There's all kinds of signs out there. If you've had a hiring freeze on for a while, if they're telling you to cut back on travel and those expenses, if you are in a dying or shrinking industry, shouldn't be any surprise that layoffs are coming. So those are all signs to keep aware of. But just the fact that you kind of know something's out there doesn't mean that you are prepared for the day when it actually happens to you.
I suppose the obvious advice is start saving as much as you can from week to week. But any other steps you take kind of before the axe falls?
Cash is totally king. So you want to look at any kind of obligation you can either avoid, you know, don't take on big new payments, reduce somehow, or eliminate. You want to start looking at your health insurance coverage. Now, a lot of people say, well, I'm laid off. I can just take COBRA, which extends your benefits. COBRA is usually the worst solution because it's so expensive. So you want to start looking at other alternatives, other possibilities, maybe a high deductible plan. Maybe you could get added to a spouse's plan. These are the things to start investigating before the axe actually falls.
Is there any way to tell if, for example, taking a buyout offer is better than trying to stick with a job?
This is a really tough one since it's so individual. I would say, is your industry growing? Is your company growing? Even if this is a temporary setback, you know, is the path ahead looking pretty good? Then maybe you might want to hang on and ignore the buyout. All too often, though, buyouts are coming because your company or your industry is shrinking or dying. And if it is, you really want to look hard at that because if you're one of the first people out, you can take advantages of the opportunities. You can kind of get ahead of your peers. If you keep turning down those buyout offers, you're going to be behind the curve. But also, chances are you're going to be higher on the list for layoffs, which are inevitably coming, or the buyout offers themselves are going to get worse.
What about options concerning retirement? If you've lost your job, hopefully you have already started saving for that. But what happens to a pension, a 401k plan, when you're shown the door?
401k plans are enormously portable, which is great. When you get your next job, you probably can transfer your balance to your new employer's plan. If you don't want to wait, you can roll it over into an IRA. The one thing you don't want to do is cash it out. A lot of people are reluctant to cut back on their expenses. They start draining their retirement fund. Well, what happens is they wind up draining their retirement funds, and it takes longer than they think to get to the next job.
And you're also going to have a pretty big tax hit then.
That's a big part of it. You're going to pay one-third to one-half, depending on your tax bracket, of whatever you take out in taxes. And you don't want to be facing that big tax bill.
And a pension?
Pensions, normally you keep what you've accrued to that point, but every pension's a little bit different. That's something you want to talk to with your HR department about what to do with that, what your guaranteed benefit will be when you get to retirement age.
Liz Pulliam-Weston is the personal finance columnist for MSN Money and the author of Easy Money. Thanks so much for your help.
Thank you, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by gather.com, where people can stay in touch with who they know and what they love. You can discover unsigned musicians, discuss books, share pictures, and keep up with the world. People are talking. Gather.com. And by the Henry Luce Foundation, seeking to increase American understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
All right, we're back with Getting Personal. And, Chris, we have an email from Julie. and she is in Peoria, Illinois. So Julie is 27 years old, and she's going back to school for her master's this fall. Good for her. The program that she's going into costs $50,000. She's got about $10,000 in cash and about $37,000 in an IRA. Her question is, should she pull the money out of her IRA to avoid taking on student loan debt to go to school? And I have a feeling I know exactly what your answer is going to be here. She should not be pulling money out of her retirement fund, right?
Absolutely. And you've seen that calculation, and there are variations of it. If you invest, what you got, $37,000, so between 25 and 35, and you end up with $37,000, and then you don't add any more into the IRA, but you wait till you're 60 to start pulling it out, you do really well. It's the magic of compound interest. If you start at 35 and go to 60, you don't do as well. And the other aspect is you're going to get a master's degree. It's an investment. So the question that Julie has to ask herself, and everybody who is going back to school needs to ask themselves, are you going to get the kind of boost in income over your career that it will pay, more than pay for itself, this investment? And the way that it pays for itself is that you're going to increase your earnings and you're going to increase your job prospects. But in the end, we get emails sometimes from people who have taken on $40,000, $50,000 of debt, and the career prospects aren't there, the earnings aren't there, and they're drowning in debt. So make sure this degree pays for itself. Don't tap the IRA.
All right. Our website is marketplace.org. You can click on the Getting Personal link there or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, let's hit the phones again. And our next caller designs maps, but she needs some direction in getting a home loan, Chris. Erin is calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Erin.
Hello.
What kind of maps do you design?
Well, I work for a small company. We do custom maps for textbooks, magazines, local governments, the federal government.
What's the coolest map you ever designed?
Well, one great project I worked on was a census atlas of the U.S. based on the year 2000 data. It just came out recently, actually.
Wow. So that shows where people are making the most money, where they're paying the most for homes, all that sort of thing?
It does have all that kind of information. There's a couple chapters on income, on housing.
Well, that sounds fascinating. So what kind of directions do you need from us?
My question is, my husband and I are currently looking to buy our first house, and a mortgage lender told us they have a loan that doesn't require PMI, private mortgage insurance. Although the interest rate is a little higher than what we could get with a conventional loan, but it seems like it might be a good idea since it keeps the payment lower and the interest would be tax deductible, I guess.
When you say the interest rate is higher, how much higher?
With a 5% down payment, it would be about 1% higher, but with a 10% down payment, it would be 3/8% higher.
Okay.
The other aspect of this kind of loan is it doesn't have any closing costs associated with it. And so we were thinking, well, gosh, if we don't have to pay closing costs, we could pay a 10% down payment instead of the 5% we were looking at.
Well, what do you think, Chris? Obviously, this is going to involve some math on our part, figuring out
yes.
PMI payments versus interest payments over the length of the loan.
Yes. You know, in general, I applaud this innovation in the market. I mean, it's not a scam. It's not one of those, this is too good to be true. It may not be the right option for them, but it is a legitimate option to think through. So it's absolutely right. You pay a slightly higher interest rate. You don't have the closing costs, and you're not paying private mortgage insurance. But let's just get rid of the category. In a sense, you are paying for private mortgage insurance in the sense that you're paying a higher interest rate, but that's deductible.
Aren't both deductible, Chris? Isn't PMI deductible as well?
PMI is now deductible. Typically, over the life of a loan, if you pay what we call a point, and you can buy down the interest rate that you pay, and over time, that typically tends to pay for itself. But let's say you need the cash or you want to make a bigger down payment. This is a good move that you can make. So what I would do is take this as one of your options, then take a look at an option where you pay perhaps 1 point and then decide which way you want to go. And then the trade-offs that you'll face, if you did have private mortgage insurance, one of the changes that's happened in the market is that private mortgage insurance now essentially gets canceled once you are at the 20% threshold in terms of equity value. It's mandatory at 78%. You can request it at 80%. So private mortgage insurance does disappear. If you did stay in this home for 30 years, you would be continuing to pay the slightly higher interest rate. So if the numbers work for you, this is a valid option. I still get some other quotes just to see and then just run the numbers and then pick the one that you come out ahead on. And it all has to do with this cash that you have, how much of a down payment you want to do. I'd lean toward the more conservative 10% over the 5% myself.
And I'll put in my 2 cents here in that, boy, I would like any sort of loan where you don't have to pick through the details of the closing costs.
Oh, yeah.
Because they are almost impossible to decipher amongst all the fees that you have to pay. It's just, oh, it is an absolute labyrinth. And not having to go through closing costs is a bonus.
Some of those closing costs, I owe what? $250?
Yeah, $250 for photocopying.
Right.
Yeah. So, Erin, have you run the numbers?
It did look like even over the life of the loan, we might end up paying a little bit less. And this would be comparing 5% with PMI to the 10% no-fee loan.
So you've read this map very well, which is understandable given what you do for a living.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
And thanks for all your help.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, Chris, unfortunately, that's it for this show. But as we've been telling folks, you are now answering personal finance questions online every weekday. Folks can visit our website at marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link. And you can also call us. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Des.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's finally over, the contest that has run for months with candidates mugging for the cameras, pleading for votes. You decided, and David Cook is our new American Idol. But there is another prize fight in the wings. Two contestants with long histories of success in their fields. I'm talking, of course, about the Apple iPhone 2.0 versus the BlackBerry Bold. For all you smartphone smarties who just can't decide which one to buy, Bonnie Cha is here. She's an editor with CNET.com. Bonnie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Is this all hype, or is there actually something to these new versions of the iPhone and the BlackBerry? Should we care?
We should care, but I think the comparison, if you're comparing the BlackBerry Bold to the iPhone 2, that's a problem. I don't think they're, you know, aimed towards the same audiences. I think just because they're kind of arriving at the same time and they have some of the same features, people are very quick to compare the two. But the Bold is definitely more targeted towards business users, whereas the iPhone 2 still has kind of that consumer reach. So,
but isn't Apple actually trying to get into the business community through allowing folks to use Outlook, Microsoft Outlook?
Right. So they are definitely trying to reach more of that business user. But I still think as far as BlackBerry goes with the Bold, I think they're still very much corporate centric.
What is the difference then? If one is targeted at the business community, one is targeted at consumers, is that really all that matters?
No, it's not. You know, and it's part of the design. And it's also if you're someone who heavily relies on email and messaging, you might want to go with the BlackBerry. Whereas the iPhone, you know, focuses more on maybe multimedia and web surfing. So, you know, depending on your lifestyle, things like that are worth considering.
What about cost?
They are saying the BlackBerry Bold will go for around $300 to $400. It is going to come to AT&T first. So it'll be up to them to really set the final price on that. As far as the iPhone 2, they're saying could be as low as $200. But again, you know, nothing's been confirmed. So we'll have to see.
So the iPhone 2, if it is $200, that would be on par with the old iPhone then, or the reduced price iPhone that came out, what, 2 months after
right.
the original?
Yeah, it's about in that range.
And with these new phones, will it be like the old ones where you don't automatically get things like email push and internet access and texting where all those cost you additional money?
Right. If you want the most out of your money, you'll want to sign up for like a monthly plan so you can get, you know, unlimited web access or text messaging and things like that. So, you know, that's something to be aware of when you're going in to perhaps purchase these phones.
Well, I mentioned earlier, you know, the big brouhaha over Apple dropping its price on the iPhone a couple months after it introduced it. Is it even worth going out and getting these high-tech gadgets as soon as they come out?
That's the problem with tech always is, you know, should you wait or should you get it now? there's always going to be something out in the horizon that, you know, it's going to be better in the future. But if you're really wanting it, I say go for it.
And then you'll just pay the price if the price drops later on.
Probably regret it and say I should have waited. But, you know, that goes with anything in tech, I think, these days.
Right. We should bring in some other brands. Nokia, Samsung have smartphones. Are these more affordable?
Yeah, they are affordable, especially Samsung. They get a lot of carrier backing, you know, with all the carriers. So you're going to get a little break in price. And you can get, you know, a Samsung smartphone from anywhere to like $150 to $300. Nokia, they have some really great high-end smartphones, but they don't always get picked up by U.S. carriers. So that means you're going to have to pay for an unlocked version, which means you're not locked down to a carrier, but you also don't get the carrier price break. So, for instance, the Nokia N95 has been compared to the iPhone a lot. However, you're going to pay about $500 to $700 for that phone.
Okay. What do you use?
I use a BlackBerry.
So will you be buying the new BlackBerry?
See, that's another thing. I just bought the BlackBerry Curve and now I'm kicking myself for not, you know, waiting. But, you know, I'm a huge texter and email person and I like having that tactile buttons. I like the full QWERTY keyboard, which is why I chose that over the iPhone.
All right. Bonnie Cha is senior editor at CNET. Thanks so much for your help today.
You're welcome.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, I'd have hoped we were past the point of stories about how men feel about women who make more money than them. But we're not.
My fiancé out-earns me, and let me recommend to every man out there that that is the way to go.
Okay, I guess we'll call that progress. Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fergali, with Stephen Hoffman, Janae Darden, James Richter, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tessa Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.